get all the quotes again, and then look up examples and find patterns of the usage of plural majesty throughout the Old Testament. And I think it's really worthwhile to be done on that.
So it isn't so much that there is a certain form that has plural majesty.
There isn't a separate form for plural majesty. Plural majesty is determined by contextual considerations. In other words, it's primarily determined by the fact that you've got a plural form of singular pronouns or verb forms, and that breaks your concord automatically. You know, you're supposed to have concord between the number of the noun and the number of the verb form. But when you don't have that concord, you see that there's something that's being done purposefully to express a different grammatical device, and that's the way it's identified. So, for Elohim using singular verbs and pronouns, that shows you your plural majesty. The same thing happens in Job with the word behemoth. It's the same thing.
So if you came across another plural, though, it may not necessarily be a plural majesty. It might be a plural
something else. Yeah, there's an extent. There's a range of different kinds of things that are emphasized with a plural. Sometimes it may not be majesty because it's not talking about a person. It may be talking about an object or something, and it may be just trying to intensify the idea, and so they have a plural of extent, for example, and so forth, where they're trying to, you know, like the word for life, for example, is plural, and they're trying to kind of show the full range of life and all the experiences of life or something like that, and they'll do it that way. So, that's basically it. But I really would like to have somebody, because it is an issue, you know, that Trinitarians are going to bring up, somebody do a super thorough and scholarly study on plural majesty with clear, concrete examples written out and so forth, so that the point could be developed point by point. The information's there in the books; it just hasn't been put together the way it should be.
There's all kinds of discussions on that. No one had a nice clear article just written on that alone.
I know it. That's the kind of thing that needs to be done. First, you know, even the oneness books that I've read, you know, I maybe have a little quotation here or there from somebody, but somebody ought to do a real thorough study on it and kind of settle the question once for all. And so anybody brings it up, we can just, you know, lay this thesis out. Now, if you really want to know about plural majesty, you know, we'll talk about it. But, you know, like I said, in Hebrew, it's such a commonly used thing. It's just like, you know, a construct relationship or anything else. You know, you'll just find the basic raw grammatical rule in most of the books, and they won't say much more about it. That just is the way it is, and they're not trying to prove that it is or that or anything else. I mean, they just know it is, and that's the way it is. I mean, when we had Elias in here last year, remember, we just, you know, to him, what's the deal? What's the problem? You know, he just grew up with that all along, and so there's no question that it's a part of Hebrew grammar, and it's.
You know what the argument is? So I ran into this. I never heard it before. Well, don't you know, they didn't really start using Elohim was the only usage of it like that in the Old Testament, and it wasn't until 400 years, I don't know where you got the information, it wasn't until 400 years later or something like that when they started using it for kings and that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in other words, it's a late date thing, and so therefore...
That argument is totally irrelevant. It has nothing to do with the kings of England or anybody else. Whether they got it from this or not is irrelevant. The fact is that the grammatical device is there in the scripture, and it's there not only with Elohim, but it's there in the book of Job, probably the oldest book in the Old Testament as far as the Hebrew is concerned, in Behemoth there in Job 40. There's one example you've got where it's used independent of considerations of the Godhead, and right there in the Hebrew, long before anybody ever thought about it. Kings being plural or anything else. So that's the thing I always stress, because I see Brumbach brings this big thing up about kings of England and all of this, and perhaps part of it is because some oneness scholars have maybe made a mistake here by laying too much emphasis on that, by saying, well, you know how it is, like the kings of England say we the king of England and so forth. And if you use that as an analogy, maybe, or just an expression of the fact that English can sometimes use plurals a little bit more loosely, that would be all right, but not as a proof point for your point, because this has nothing to do with kings of England. This has to do with Hebrew grammar. And I think a mistake may have been made on the oneness side, perhaps, and that generated a reaction by Brumbach on the other side and saying, no, that's a late date thing and so forth. That has nothing to do with scripture. And he's right about that. Whatever the truth is about plural of majesty in the scripture is concerned has to be explained relative to the Hebrew terms and to the Hebrew language of that time, not to something later on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, you get some of those too.
He goes through it all the way.
Yeah.
Goes back to the rest of the paragraph. Goes the other direction, taking a left.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes that'll happen.
They can use the phrase themselves.
Sometimes they never got the point, you know. They just didn't get the point. Poor old majesty to them is Trinity, you know. So, there's not much you can do about that.
Have you ever
That's another thing you can do. And the God said, yeah, you can go ahead and use plural pronouns all the way through. If it's plurality, because it's plurality of persons, then you should use personal pronouns in the plural all the way through. Yeah, that's, I've done that on occasion too, just to show them the foolishness of it. But then they'll say, well, it's three in one, you know. And but the thing is it three persons in one person? And they don't want to say one person, because that you know, to them, if you say God is one person, you're a heretic. So God is three persons, but he's still one God. But if he's three persons, then you need personal pronouns, and we're talking about persons, then we need personal pronouns that are appropriate to three persons, and we should use us all the time. So that's another thing that can be done. And like I say, within the context of Hebrew, there's no problem whatsoever. It's not even an issue. It's a non-issue. It's just a grammatical device. And that's why, you know, Price was saying that, trying to look this up in some of the books, they may make a simple statement of it, but that's all. There's no elaboration on it at all. And the reason for it is it's just a simple grammatical point. Most of the, you know, the grammars and so forth, usually they'll bring it up for something when they introduce the word God in the vocabulary or something, and then just like this book did. But all he said was, you know, it's plural in form, singular in sense, and then we just take it and go from there, you know. And it's no big issue. When I took Hebrew from the Jewish professor, same thing, you know. It wasn't any big thing at all. Of course, he wasn't thinking of Trinity or anything else. That's really important to emphasize that when you're talking to the people, because they... And you'll get the people who knew something about Hebrew, and then got converted, you know, we say we're a Jew and got converted to Christianity, and then they adopt the doctrine of Trinity, and then what they'll do sometimes is try to find places in Hebrew that they can stuff the Trinity in, and then they'll claim, oh, here's a revelation we never saw before, you know, I mean, this is plural for a different reason than we thought. And then, the El Shaddai argument, you know, the three vertical strokes joined by one horizontal stroke, and, you know, you get in all this kind of mumbo jumbo, but you can just as easily say, well, the word Yahweh starts with the word Yo, that's just one little stroke, and it's proving that God is one. You know, and you could play any game you wanted. You could pick a letter with two strokes. If you wanted to believe in a duality, you could pick a Chet, two vertical strokes joined by one horizontal. You know, I mean, you could do anything you wanted when you start playing games like that. So, but from the standpoint of Hebrew, it's just a grammatical device, and after you've gotten familiar with Hebrew, you see that they do all kinds of funny things that we don't do, and nothing surprises you after a while. Okay. Well, going on with our review, we left off on page 64, lesson 15, talking about the final remarks on Asher, and this was that situation where we ran into what we call a resumptive pronoun, and this may be the perhaps the most difficult aspect of the use of Asher, although it's really not too much of a problem. Let me put it this way. It will not be a problem for you when you're translating from the text. When you have the text and you see that presumptive pronoun, you'll know what to do with it. You can't do anything else with it. The problem would be if you were making composition and you were going to try to use a relative clause or something, and using it with Asher, you might forget to put the relative pronoun in there, or that resumptive pronoun. You might forget it sometime. But if you're going from Hebrew to English, you won't have any trouble with this. And it's a little bit awkward to our way of thinking, but once you get used to it again, it's no problem. The problem essentially is this. They don't like to put a preposition on the word Asher. And so in English, see, we have phrases like to whom or for whom, where we take our relative pronoun, whom, and so forth, and then put a preposition on it. They don't like to do that in Hebrew. And so they wouldn't put a b or something, or a l or something on Asher. So instead, what they'll do is they'll put the pronoun idea back into the clause after the Asher. And so here's some examples. And just to remind you, Ha'ish Asher Nathati Lo Et Hakesef, literally it would be the man who I gave the silver to him. You see, because that to him there, that low is in there. And it sounds a bit redundant to us because, you know, you don't have, in English, you don't have to, you just say the man to whom I gave the silver, and you wouldn't have to repeat the hint to him. But in Hebrew, they repeat this resumptive pronoun idea. You just start the whole thing with asher, and then they'll use a resumptive pronoun lo there to express that idea so that you can still get the idea of to and get that indirect object idea, but not have to put the preposition lamet on asher, which they don't like to do for some reason. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Sometimes in English, in proper grammar.
Yes, that's right. Sure. That'll happen sometimes, and you'll hear a person talk that way, and you'll... Now they know what you're doing, even though they know it's wrong. You know, they know what you're doing, and that can happen, sure. And here, this is the next example, the city from which they came. You know, the city which they came from it. You know, you can imagine people talking like that. Okay. And especially if you get a long sentence, sometimes if the sentence is really long or phrase is really long. So either the person will have forgotten that what he did, and then he'll put the thing in, or he may be afraid that the person he's talking to will forget or something, and he'll put that resumptive thing in there. That'll happen sometimes. Sometimes we don't even pay attention to it in spoken English, but we'd probably get some marks down for it if we ever wrote it down. Okay, then there will also be an instance where it won't be a pronoun, but it'll be one of these adverbs, sham or shama, that kind of takes the place of it. The city in which he dwelt, for example. Ha'ir Asher Yashav Sham, and literally the city which he dwelt there, and so that can happen in place names at least. Okay, then the resumptive pronoun is optional when Asher refers to the direct object of the verb. You can get by without putting the resumptive pronoun in if it's a direct object. In other words, if it would have been something with F on it, you can leave it out and there won't be any problem. So instead of saying Ha'ish Asher Shalakhti Otho, the man whom I sent, or the man who I sent him, literally, you can go ahead and get by with just Ha'ish Asher Shalakhti. You'll see it more often that way. So that's maybe a little of exception to the rule, or it's just so commonly used that they didn't generate any ambiguity, so they left it. All right. Then a few other notes on Asher are more rare types of situations. Point number one here at the top of the page, Asher tends to take on a compound relative meaning that which. So you can even start off a whole clause with a phrase and it sends that which or the fact that or something of this nature. And you have to get that primarily from contextual considerations. We'll be looking a little bit later on in the book at kinds of clause relationships. We've already done some work, of course, with the while consecutive clauses, but we'll be looking at other types of clause relationships and see some more specifics on this. So at this point, it's not really worth spending a lot of time with it. And there are times when Asher acquires an independent pronominal status, in which case it functions almost like a pronoun, and then it can take a preposition, at least a few of them. So there's a couple of almost exceptional examples here. Ya'an Asher, meaning because, or because of the fact that. Achare Asher, after. And Ka Asher, as or according as or when. You do see some examples where Asher does seem to take a preposition. They kind of explain it as it takes on an independent pronominal status, so it almost functions like a noun now and independent and so forth, and no longer relative, and explain it that way. Either that, or you can just call it an exception or something if you want it, just that you note that kind of thing does happen. Okay, and then he just gives a couple of examples where Asher is completely left out, and the context just lets you know that it's an Asher clause. Asyndetic use is what it's often termed. And that term asyndetic you'll see in other grammars too. It's generally used when things that ought to be there are left out. And so we see that example. That happens more in poetry than in prose, though. Yeah, that's the last statement he makes there. So that's something you just kind of have to pick up. We will, when we're doing translating, we'll see some unusual things like that. We'll just have to kind of remember, well, here's a situation where Asher was left out or something, and just to call it to our attention. Okay, that brings us to the construct chain in lesson 16, and we've been eagerly awaiting here to review. Remember that in Greek you have a genitive case to describe possession and that type of thing. Hebrew doesn't have a genitive case, but it uses a grammatical device known as this construct relationship to transmit the same meaning. So if you think of this kind of a structure as transmitting the same kind of meaning that you saw the genitive case do in Greek, it may help. And if you haven't had Greek, then just think of it as possession or something. I think all of you have had at least some exposure to it. So there is in biblical Hebrew no preposition having the same range of meaning expressed by the English of. The of relationship, the genitive case of the classical languages, has its correspondent in the construct chain. The construct chain basically involved putting two nouns together and usually modifying the first one a little bit along the lines of some kind of shortening, if it can take it. And so we have examples here, Kol Hanavi, the voice of the prophet, the voice of the prophet, and Melech Haaretz, the king of the land. Now notice something about this. We have an article only on the last word, not on the first word. And yet the first word is also getting a definite concept. It's not a voice of the prophet, but the voice of the prophet. It's not a king of the land, but the king of the land. So that's something to remember about construct relationships. So the definiteness of the whole entire expression is determined by the definiteness of the last noun in the series. So he says here the first noun in such a chain is said to be in the construct state, and the second noun is said to be in the absolute state. As a general terminology, he talks about bound versus free. Also, apparently, some of the new age linguists are using those terms. And he mentions here down at the bottom, the first noun loses its primary stress, becomes proclitic to the second noun. That's kind of a theoretical consideration. In some instances, in some words, it becomes an actual proclitic with makef, and you lose the stress completely, like Ben. That's one example. Ben Hamelech, the son of the king. That word Bane now has shortened down to Ben, and you've got a makef, and the stress is lost. So it happens in that case. But the vast majority of the cases, there's no stress change at all. And the word retains its stress, like Melech Haaretz, the king of the land. Melech has got its stress just like it normally had. Although a lot of these words will shorten a little bit, and that's perhaps where you'll see this tendency to kind of push the weight to the end. It shortens down a little bit, but it really won't lose its stress in most cases. So that's what he leads into next at the top of the next page. More important than stress difference, however, is the change in vocalization found in many words. So, for example, we get Davar Hamelech. Instead of Davar, you get Davar Hamelech. You get a shortening down to a schwa in the first syllable. That's going to be the details of that are going to come a little bit later in the chapter, where we give you that little chart to remember how to do it. Now, a few more. I'm going to kind of skip through this fairly quickly, but I don't want to leave anything that's important that you might have forgotten. But hitting the main points, notice only the final noun in a construct chain near the top of page 68 may have the definite article. The definiteness of the entire expression depends on the second noun, or actually the last noun in general, because you may have more than one noun in a series, or more than two. But it's the last noun that determines the definiteness of the whole thing. So, examples, Kol Hanavi, the voice of the prophet, contrasted with Kol Navi, a voice of a prophet. Now, that brings up a question. What if you wanted to say a voice of the prophet, for example? If you had a something of the something, something more specific. There is a way to do that, and they do it with the preposition lameth. And so you see examples here. This doesn't happen very often, but for example, in this phrase, Mizmor le David, a psalm of David. If you're wanting to talk about one of many things that a certain person is characterized by a certain thing, you can use that expression. And literally, it's a psalm to David. You know, a psalm with reference to David is kind of the idea. Mm-hmm.
But at the first example, the law had a hapak,
Which example are you looking at now? Up above?
Yeah.
Davar?
Lamelech. Davar Asher.
Oh, Davar Asher Lamelech. Oh, okay. That isn't a construct relationship anymore.
Oh.
See, it's just a different idiom. So that's the reason. See, you've got the prepositional phrase Lamadon Melech. Even if you had the Asher out of there, Davar Lamelech, it wouldn't be construct now because you have the preposition Lamad. You actually just have a prepositional phrase modifying the other noun. So that's the reason there's no shortening or anything. And that would just mean, again, a word to the king. In other words, a word with reference to the king, a word attributed to the king. It's kind of the idea, I think, that they're trying to express by that. So they're just using a prepositional phrase modifying a noun, which is just a normal construction, just like Haish Babayev, you know, the man is in the house or something. Same kind of thing here, structurally at least. Okay. Now, it didn't say anything about wanting to say the something of a something, that maybe they just avoid that, because they do avoid a lot of things. All right? You just don't say that in Hebrew. All right? Another point is that you can pluralize either one of the nouns in the construct chain. It doesn't apply only to singular nouns, but also to plural nouns. And the full instructions for doing that will be given in Lesson 18. But he does give some examples here. And we may wait till Lesson 18 to go into more detail on that. But Devar ha-Nevi'im, the word of the prophets, plural. Or you can have Divrei ha-Navi, the words, plural, of the prophets, singular. Or you can have Divrei ha-Nevi'im, the words, plural, of the prophets, plural. So either one of them can be plural in a construct relationship, or both of them, or, you know, the first one, the second one, whatever. Any adjective modifying either noun must follow the entire chain. That's another rule about construct relationships. Adjectives that modify either one of the nouns in the chain are going to follow the entire construct chain. They're not going to get in and split up that construct relationship. That's a word order relationship that can't be broken up, because then you'll lose the function of what's happening. So the adjective comes at the end of the entire chain, and that adjective may refer to either one of the nouns. Now the question is, how do you tell whether the adjective refers to the first noun in the construct chain or the second noun? Anybody? Yeah, it's your person and number. It's that concord between person and number that's going to tell you. See, the adjective will not change its form into a construct form or something like that to grow the construct or state absolute. It'll just be in its absolute form. So the only thing you're going to be able to pick up on is person and number. And, of course, that means that if your two nouns both happen to be masculine singulars, then you've got to go by context. But if one noun in the construct chain happened to be feminine, one was masculine, and the adjective was feminine, you'd know the adjective went with the first one, and vice versa. But you may not always have enough information to tell. And of course, if it was number of singulars and plurals, you could tell too. But if you had both singulars and both plurals, then you're out of luck again. So that's the size. That's about the summation of everything that we see in the bottom of this page here. Okay, and then he says the use of two adjectives, one modifying each noun, is avoided. So they just avoid that to find another way to say it or completely circumvent the whole situation so that you're not having, whatever adjectives you have are only going to modify one of the two nouns in the construct relationship. Okay, then the construct chain may be extended to three or more nouns, but examples of four or more are very rare. So you'll see three or more sometimes, the three, but getting to four or above is pretty rare to find. So here's an example, Asheth ben Hanavi, the wife of the son of the prophet. So you have three nouns in the construct chain there, but to have four or more is real rare. Okay, then occasionally and usually with fixed expressions, the first or second noun of a construct chain may be replaced by a longer phrase. These are just idiomatic considerations primarily, and I don't think we'll even bother to go through those again, but you can look at them for your own reference. Those are things we'll run into once in a while, but not very often. Then at the bottom of the page is getting into the concept of what the meaning is. Precise meaning of a construct chain is difficult to define, while a rough translation of using of or the possessive, as in the king's son, will often suffice. So either using of or possession, basically like genitive in Greek, either translated by of, preposition of, or by simple possession. But he says there are many instances where an adjective or prepositional phrase is better. That's questionable in my opinion, just because for the same reason that you can use a genitive phrase in Greek and sometimes translate by an adjective in English too. And since the language can probably do both, now with Hebrew you may be a little bit more justified because sometimes Hebrew won't have an adjective that will fit. So they may just use a construct relationship. Nevertheless, a stone tablet here, you see, Luach Evan, literally is a tablet of stone. And, you know, a person says, what's the difference between a stone tablet and a tablet of stone? There may not be in that instance, but there may be situations where there might be slightly different emphasis and so forth. And I think we just need to be a little bit more careful about that. I'd rather you be a little more literal and things like that, just to preserve the tenor of what was given, even if it's just a matter of emphasis. Okay, then the form of the construct singular, the last section in this chapter. How do we make a construct singular? Construct form of a singular noun exclusive of feminines and ah, which you have to put, there's another qualification there, you change the ah to an ah. But, and we'll get to that next chapter, I think. But otherwise, there's a relatively simple rule involved. And there's three sections to it. Unstressed theri and comments are replaced by schwa. So if you find a theri or a comment that doesn't have a stress on it, then that means it's generally going to be in the first or second syllable. Because most words are you know, stressed on the ultimate. That's going to reduce to schwa. Now that may introduce a complication that may face plunge you into a situation of having to use rule of schwa. You might get something that a word that has schwa already in the first syllable, and the second one was unstressed and it was a comment and it got shortened. Especially with plurals, this happens, and then you'll get your rule of schwa. You'll have to put a hirik in the first syllable or something. That'll happen. We'll see that especially in plurals. The second rule is that comments in a final closed syllable is replaced by pathak. That's something a little different than what you've seen before. This is a shortening from a comments to pathak. And if it's in a final closed syllable, that's what will happen. Then a theri in a final closed syllable usually remains unchanged, but in a small number of words is replaced by pathak. So theri is in a final closed syllable can do one or the other, either stay the same or be replaced by pathak. And generally it stays the same. So you see examples here and a list of what rule was applied. So if you have any, if you're fuzzy on this, I would recommend just reading through the example and seeing and understanding each one what has happened. Just taking the first two there, we have yad, for example. That's only a monosyllabic word, but it in the final closed syllable you have a comment and that is reduced to pathak according to the rule number two up there. Makom. You get a shortening of the first syllable there. You have a comments in an unstressed syllable, and that reduces, according to rule number one, to schwa. So that's the basic idea there. Let's see, anything more complicated? Shofate down there is rule number three. It didn't change. And those you just have to know. There isn't any way to guess at it, whether it's going to do one or the other. And some don't change at all. Things like melech, for example. It's got two short syllables already. There's no comments or teri in it. So that nothing's going to happen to it, and so it just stays melek. And sefer is going to stay the same because even though it's got a seri, it's a stressed one, so it's not going to shorten. Okay, any questions on those formation of constructs? Those rules are well worth committing to memory, though, because the next couple chapters refer back to the same set of rules for the plurals and for the feminines. You've got some little other thing to do, and then you apply those same rules. Okay, construct singular minor types, lesson 17. These just show some of the exceptions to the previous rules. The first two words, av and ach, words for father and brother, are a little strange in that they get a hirik yod in the construct. And that's worthy of note because you don't want to confuse that with the hirik yod that's going to come up a little bit later on, which is what? You can stick a hirik yod on the end of a noun. First person suffix, for that pronominal suffix. So like susi would be my horse. And so you don't want to think that this is the same as Avi, my father. You know, you don't want to think it's my father. It's just father in construct. Okay. Then all patterns, all nouns of the patterns, bayeth, if we like bayeth and maweth and so forth, show a regular contraction. And you get bath or moth, either a contraction for the ayah goes to tsereoth and the awa goes to cholomwal. So that's a real common pattern. And construct form of bane is commonly proclitic, so you get ben. A similar form occurs for shame, but much less frequently. So you may see shim, something where she's got a shorter form for name. A few nouns outwardly identical to the type zakain and the construct zakan have an unusual construct form. And so a lot of them, of course, will follow the patterns of the previous rules, but some of them will just do something different. They'll become segalits. So kathay, for example, becomes kethet. And yarech becomes yerech. So you just have to, again, learn some of those. That's why in the vocabularies, if the thing's got an unusual construct like that, it'll put the construct in parentheses. It'll tell you what it is. Nouns ending in segol he have construct forms in seri he. That's kind of the reverse of what you normally expect. It actually lengthens. So sadeh becomes sadeh in construct. Machaneh becomes machaneh. So that's kind of different than what you normally expect. Then there's quite a few other exceptions to the rules, and they're just going to be dealt with as you come, and just they give you the irregular construct form. Then the ones that are feminine nouns ending in ah. The question there is what to do with that final syllable. Does it change? Since there's a comments in Well, since it's a stress syllable, and since the commas is there, you might expect nothing to happen to it there. But what happens is that they have a standard kind of replacement whereby the commas hey becomes pathak tau. Pathak tau. So you replace that with pathak tau and then apply the rest of the rules. So it's just a matter of making one more operation on it and then applying the rules that you had before. So shana, for example, becomes shanath. Shanath. You replace the ah with pathak tau and get as there, or as. And then you get shawa in the first syllable because of the reduction of the commas in the unstressed syllable. Okay. Maybe the one worth looking at is the second to the last one in that list, beracha. Okay, beracha, you replace the commas hey with pathak tau, but now you have also this commas in an unstressed syllable. That's going to go to shawa, but that would mean now you've got two shawas in a row. Can't allow that, so rule of shawa comes into effect, and so you get a hirik on the first syllable. So it becomes birkat.
The navigation there is
late. On the kaf, yes, that would just be your dagesh lane for your. What's happened is the syllable's now closed, and you're beginning a new syllable, so you want the hard sound. Yeah, good. Okay. Then two types of variations from the norm are common. It gives two consistent types of variation, just like you see with those things in the first part of the chapter. Milchama becomes milchemeth. You get a segalit pattern. So there's certain nouns, trisyllabic nouns, that begin with a closed syllable are the ones that usually follow this pattern. So again, it's just a matter of getting used to them and learning them in the vocabulary primarily. Then he says sometimes the expected reduction of seri to seri or commas to shawa does not take place. This is by and large unpredictable and will require a special note. So that's just strange. You expect it to go, but it doesn't. So berecha, for example, for pan becomes berechath. And this one may be logical in a certain sense, because if it did reduce, then it wouldn't look any different than berchath above. And the word for blessing and the word for pond would be exactly the same in construct. So that may be part of the reason why sometimes words are exceptional, because they may line up to be look like another word if they're not, and they purposely made a change. That is the case here, apparently. Okay. Then most feminine, now last statement, most feminine nouns ending in af, eth, uth, eth, etc., in the absolute are not susceptible to further change in the construct form. Those that are follow the rules. The construct of Isha is quite irregular. Asheth, that's just totally irregular, and you don't have any way of really predicting that. Okay, so we've got some guidelines, but it's not going to answer all of our questions. We do need to recognize that vocabulary is involved in learning the construct very often as well. Construct forms of plural nouns in Eem, lesson 18. This really wasn't anything brand new. All you have to do is make a certain substitution and then apply those same rules that we saw back in chapter 16. In this case, for plural nouns in im, this would include masculines or feminines in that category. Most of them, of course, are masculine, but some could be feminine. But if the plural ends in im, you take the im off and replace it by seriyoth. That's the first thing you do. Then you make the reductions in accordance with the rules with what you've got left over. So yamim, for example, becomes yamei. The im is replaced by seriyoth, and then the comments is reduced to shawa according to the rules, so you get yamei. So a lot of these get real short. You know, you had a big long plural word, and they get pretty short when they get in construct. So I think that's pretty straightforward. There's nothing really difficult or new about that. So unless there's questions, we'll just leave it at that. And one example down here for divarim, again, you get rule of shawa involved, because you replace the im with seriyoth, and then you have a comet in that unstressed syllable that reduces to shawa, which would give you two shawas in a row, but the first one turns into hirikin under rule of shawa. So there's nothing unusual about that either. What was that, John? Yeah. Right, yeah, anashim. And of course, in that one, it's rule of shawa, but it's with the situation where you have a chatef pasak and a guttural, you know, that becomes a full pasak. So that's still rule of shawa, though. Good. And zikanim, same thing, zikne. Okay, then there's the problem of the Segalites. Remember, the Segalites in the plural had a pretty consistent pattern, Shoah comets. Unfortunately, that consistent pattern doesn't carry through to the constructs. And so you have to kind of think of the construct plurals of these guys as just kind of being formed in a completely independent fashion, because they won't follow the normal rules. So nouns like melech have pathak or hirik in the stem syllable of the plural construct. You wouldn't predict that, because rule of Shawa would usually give you, you would normally expect just hirik in all of those because of rule of Shawa. But it may be pathak or hirik. And all these, all the ones we've had so far happen to be pathak. So melachim, for example, becomes malche. And that's unusual. We've got avadim becomes avdei, etc. So that's a fairly consistent pattern throughout those. Nouns like sefer, with the tseri in the first syllable, have hirik, sometimes segol. So here's a couple examples with sifrei with hirik, and shiftei with hirik, but Ed Ray with Segol. I really can't help you too much on that, other than just say this is what happens. And nouns like Shoresh with a cholam in the first syllable, we have a cholam, Kamas Katuf, so Shorshe is the form for that. Then there are several nouns with irregularities in the plural construct which should be noted here. Basically, the irregularity is that there's no reduction when you expected it. So Rashim, for example, where you would have expected Rashe or something like that, it's just Rashe, and you keep the comments. This probably has something to do with the quiescent aleph in this case. But Arim becomes Ra, and Harim becomes Hare. You would have expected some, you know, reduction to Shua, and those are Khatafasa. But it doesn't happen. Construct forms of Shamayim and Mayim are Shemay and May, respectively. Later, when we get to looking at duals, we find that that's in general the case. But duals in construct look just like plurals in construct. Okay, the construct forms of noun plurals in oath. Now, if the plural ends in oath, there's no real change that takes place to that. The ending oath remains in the construct form. Now, the ending im got pulled off and serio got put in. But if it's an oath ending, that stays on. And then once, so you just take the plural and the plural form as is and apply rules number one, one, two, and three to it. So that's pretty easy. Shame, for example, shemoth is the plural and shemoth is the construct. So nothing has been done to the ending. You just have to reduce that seri to shawa according to rule one. So there's nothing too much there. Now, the same kind of problem occurs, though, in segalit types. Here again, if nouns of the type melech, sefer, shoresh, and so forth have plurals in oath, the stem vowel cannot be predicted on the basis of the rules. So you have about three in a row there. Nefesh, for example, becomes nifashoth, and then nafshoth, and there's no way to predict what that first stem vowel will be. And cherev, same thing, or it becomes charvoth. Again, you've got a pathak in the first syllable. Eretz becomes artsoth. Again, you don't really know what it's going to do. So those are unpredictable. All right, that's about the size of it. There's one last statement here. Construct plurals of feminine nouns like giv'ah and mal'ak or malka take the same vowel as the singular. So whatever the singular did, the plural feminine nouns will do in this respect. Okay, just an observation mainly. All right, so that's how to make those forms of constructs. And that's pretty much it as far as constructs alone are concerned. But, of course, we had some other things that came after the construct that kind of depended on some of the construct technology, you might say, that involved these pronominal suffixes. So we'll get to that next chapter. Lesson 19 was an introduction to the independent form of the personal pronoun. And this is probably the least commonly used. Most of your personal pronouns are attached to something, attached to a noun or attached to a preposition or something. This is your independent forms, the forms that they stand all by themselves. These are the forms you might think of as the ones from which these suffixes were derived, perhaps. Although, who knows who came first, you know, the chicken or the egg here, we don't know. But these are the independent forms. And these forms are used primarily in nonverbal sentences where you're using a predicate construction or something and you have no verb form and you use one of these pronouns. Or if you want to give special emphasis, you can have a kind of a redundant situation where you use one of these independent pronouns and then you use the verb form also with its suffix. And that will give you even more emphasis. Sometimes it's just because you're clarifying something in the context, or sometimes you really want to lay strong stress on it. So this paradigm here, we have ani for I, an optional form, anoki. You have ata for you, masculine singular, at for you, feminine singular, who for he, she, he or it, masculine singular, and he for she or it. Now, this can, why can it mean it as well as he or she? Anybody?
We don't have a neuter.
Yeah, we don't have a neuter form. That's one thing. All nouns in Hebrew are going to be either masculine or feminine. And those nouns may be describing inanimate objects. So in English, we wouldn't want to say she, you know, just because the noun happened to be feminine. But the Hebrew is going to have a form that will agree with it, with the gender of the noun. But we may translate it because it's an inanimate object. So let's put it this way. Whenever you see who or he, and the reference is obviously to an inanimate object, translate it. Don't translate it he or she. Okay. And anachnu for we, atem for you, masculine plural, aten or atena, optional form, for you, feminine plural, and Haim or Hema for they, masculine plural, and Hena for they, feminine plural. So here's the paradigm for those independent pronouns. And he makes some of the remarks talk about some of the variant forms and what, where they predominate and so forth, so we'll go through all that right now. At the bottom of the page here shows the fact that it's being used in nonverbal sentences very often. You know, for example, Ani Tov, I am good. Instead of using a verb form there, they'll just use the kind of pattern that they commonly use for that kind of thing. And just like you want to say ish tov or something, ha ish tov, that would be, you know, the man is good. So here you say ani tov or ani holech, using a participial construction, which is also nonverbal in a certain sense. The participle is technically it's got verbal sense to it, but it's also an adjective. Ani ish, I am a man, or ani babayet, I am in the house. So all of these nonverbal types of sentences can use this independent pronoun form. And of course, that would be true of any of these other pronouns too. Anachnu or something like that could be, you know, anachnu tovim or something. We could do the same thing. Okay. Interrogative pronouns then. Me and ma. Me meaning who when you're asking about a person, and ma meaning what when you're asking about a thing. And these are not inflected for number or gender, so you don't have to worry about a paradigm for them. Me is always going to be me, and ma is always going to be ma, except when it's used before gutturals, where it'll change the form a little bit. Me will be used, it won't take a different form depending on whether it's the subject or the object or object of a preposition or whatever. It's just always going to be me. You can see the examples of the usage here. Me asa et hadavar hazeh, who did this thing? There, me is the subject. Me at, who are you? There again, it's a subject, but now in a kind of a predicate kind of construction. Bas me at, whose daughter are you? Literally, the daughter of whom are you? See? And there the me is in an absolute to a word that's in construct, bas. So the daughter of whom are you? And le mi nathata es hakesef, to whom did you give the money? There the whom, Lami, you've got the preposition lamad on it, marking it as the indirect object. And so me is now functioning as the indirect object. So this me will occupy the place in the sentence that you're asking about. You see, it's a question word, and you don't know who it is, but see, sometimes you're asking a question where you want to know who is the subject of the action, other times you want to know who's the object of the action, or who's the object of the preposition phrase, or something like that. And so you've got this ability to use this in many places. Same thing happens with ma. And the form of ma, though, does change depending on, there's three criteria here. Before resh, hey, or aleph, you use the form ma with a lengthening there with a comments. Before ayin or hey, to use meh. Elsewhere, before non-guttural consonants, use ma plus the doubling of the first consonant of the following word. So you get this ma plus the doubling type of thing. So it's something analogous to the article and the preposition min and a few other things that acted this way. Any of these forms may be followed by makaif. Both me and ma are sometimes followed by a demonstrative pronoun, better left untranslated, as in ma zos asita, what have you done? And he says, better left untranslated. That's kind of a matter of opinion, too. I will admit that it's oftentimes difficult to translate it. But there's a feeling you will get, and I won't even have to tell you about it once we get into it. You may feel it already. If I just said Ma Asitha, Asitha, what have you done? But if I say Ma Zov Asitha, there's more emphasis there. Just the fact that you said another word is giving more emphasis, and it's got some more emotional impact. It's kind of, what is this that you have done? You know, it's more expressive. So. I would almost prefer you to use something like, what is this that you have done, or something as a translation, just so I can see that you got the impact of that zoth in there. Or mi zeh, who is he? You know, it's kind of like, who is this one? You know, who is this one? It's this demonstrative. You see, it's got a pointing effect. It's just like demonstratives anyplace else. It's got more of an emotional and expressive and specific pointing type of an effect, and I think that should come out somehow. Okay. Well, that brings us to chapter 20, that infamous chapter in which we found out about pronominal suffixes. And I doubt that there's any chapter that's more difficult in the book than this one, just because of the having to not only memorize a new set of endings, but also having to deal with the kinds of shortenings and so forth that will take place when you put those endings onto words. So it's about as difficult as it gets, and might as well take a crack at it here. We've got 5 more minutes, so we can at least get a start at it. Pronominal possession, such as my book, his, king, etc., is indicated in Hebrew by suffixation of the pronominal element. So if you've got pronominal possession, now what about nominal possession? What would nominal possession be? Can you think of what that would be? Say pronominal would be possession, should we're using a pronoun, my book, so forth. What if you had nominal, where you're using a full noun? Okay. I think you might have had it there. Construct, yeah. It's a construct relationship. That's nominal. That's what you call nominal possession. The book of the king, you see, where you had showing possession, but you were telling, you're telling with a specific noun who's the one that's possessing. In this case, the king. But here, if you want to say my book, or his king, or whatever, now you're using a pronoun, his, my, and so forth, rather than a full noun. And in this case, they're not going to use a construct relationship. See, this is somewhat akin to a construct type of concept, though. But instead, they're using a pronominal suffix to attach to the noun. And the forms of the pronoun attached to the singular noun are more or less the same as those used with the prepositions already studied. So you remember learning the preposition lamed with the pronominal suffixes. They're basically the same endings. The major difficulty lies, as usual, in the alterations of the nominal stem rather than in the endings. Here's the paradigm of sus. Sus is a good one to pick for this because it's got it's monosyllabic and it's got an unchangeable long vowel in it. And and it's got no gutturals, and the first two letters aren't, neither one of the two main letters are guttural, so it makes a beautiful example that's not going to get obliterated or mutilated by anything. It's kind of an impervious, solid rock there that you can stick all kinds of things on, and it's not going to change. So that's a good example. Almost all the books that I've read, almost all the grammar books, use sus for the paradigm for these pronominal suffixes, so kind of interesting. So here's the paradigm. Susi means my horse. So the word sus means horse. I had a hirikyo to the end, that means my horse. Susaka means your horse, masculine singular. Susech, your horse, feminine singular. Suso, his horse. Susa, with a mapik in the hay there, means her horse. Susenu, our horse. Susachem, your horse, your masculine plural horse. And Susachem, your feminine plural. Susam and Susan for the third person's, their horse, both masculine and feminine. Okay. He makes a point about the shawa on these two sets of forms, or actually three sets of forms altogether. In your feminine, your masculine singular, second person, Susaka there. And if you compare that shawa is to be considered as a part of the ending. And therefore, it's vocal all the time. It's always vocal. It's always going to be a vocal shawa. Over in the next column, though, the Susakim and Susakin, that Shawa is to be considered as part of the stem of the word, not part of the ending. And the reason for that comes when you get words like Davar, for example, where you get, this one happens to be an unchangeable long vowel. So there's going to be definitely an open syllable there, and this the schwa is going to have to be vocal. But if you have a closed syllable, a short vowel in the syllable just before that that will close the syllable, then that schwa will be silent. So they want you to be able to make the schwa silent or vocal depending on what the previous syllable is, and therefore they're considering that schwa as a part of the stem, subject to the normal rules that affect a vocal versus silent schwa. So that's the major point that's being made, point number two down here on underneath this paradigm. So if you just compare, for example, the Susakim and Susakin with Devarkim and Devarkin, you'll see the difference there. Devarkim, you see you've got a silent schwa because the previous syllable is being closed, and Susakim is going to be a vocal schwa because the previous syllable is open. It's an unchangeable long vowel, so it can be vocal schwa. So that's the main thing to note about those particular endings. Other than that, it's pretty straightforward. It does make mention in point number one here that the Tseri there in the second person feminine singular is always Tseri. Some of the previous systems of endings that you had, sometimes you had a comet in that position, and sometimes it's Tseri. You had Bach, Lach, Imach, but you also had Mimek that had Tseri. This ending system will always take Tseri. Okay, a few more minutes here. The hardest part, I think, has to do with this next paragraph here, just underneath the paradigm for Davar, and explaining some of the things that are happening here. It says, the shift of the stress from the noun stem to the suffix has produced the same kind of reduction we encountered in the plural and construct forms. Namely, and so their main problem is, just like with the plurals, you've got a shift in stress, and you've got a new syllable tacked onto the end of the word, and it's taking the stress. And that's going to cause some changes down the road. So, comets and Tseri in propretonic, that means two before the main stress, open syllables are replaced by schwa. The second person forms are the only ones that require comment. As suggested above, the schwa of echa is taken as a part of the suffix. This leaves the final stem syllable open, devar echa. Then the noun stem before the suffix will accordingly have in most cases the same form as the first person singular. So devar echa, the form of the noun, is going to be devar, just like it was with devari. So the form will be basically the same as far as the stem. The endings of the second person plural, however, are chem and chen without the schwa. The final syllable of the noun stem is closed, devar chem, and the vowel, if possible, is shortened. Okay. So there you get a shortening of the comets to pasach according to that second rule back there with constructs. So this isn't the same rule that we had with plurals, but it's the rule that we had with constructs. You get devarchem with pasach there and a closed syllable. The noun stem before these two suffixes is most often identical to the construct form because of the same kind of logical rule that's involved in the shortening. To understand the stem changes, then, the suffixes must be considered of two kinds. Number one, those beginning with a consonant, often called heavy, the chem and the chen, and two, those beginning with a vowel, which is all the rest, often called light. So it's the heavy ones, the ones that have the heavy suffixes, that get this extra reduction, you might say, that get the construct type of reduction. And the others just get propretonic reduction, just like you had before with the plurals. So that's perhaps the hardest thing to remember, and making sure you get that pasach, for example, instead of a comet in this particular word, davar, for chem and chen. All right, feminine, let's see, is the bell rung? Yes, it is. Feminine nouns in ah have ah before the light suffixes and ah with the pasach before the heavy suffixes. So a similar kind of thing is happening here, and basically for the same reason. You'll have a comet's tau before all the light suffixes. So Torah fi, for example, the resh has a comet. But if you look over there to the two places where the heavy suffixes occur, in your second person forms, plural, you get Toroth Kim and Toroth Hin. In each place, the comment has reduced to Pothak, according to the construct reduction rule. Okay, well, we'll stop there and wade through this one. This will probably be our slowest one, and we're probably going to end up taking most of the next week as well before we get back up to where we are. Some of those later chapters are just going to be lots of minor modifications, but I think it's still worthwhile to take it. We really haven't had a full 2 weeks because we missed one day last week, so I'd rather take the time and do it right than have a lot of loose ends. Okay.